This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. A final warning is how one climate scientist is describing the latest report by the world's most authoritative climate science body. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change says it's likely global temperatures will rise above 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels sometime in the first half of the 2030s. But it says we have the know-how and the technology to avoid it if the world acts together and quickly. National Environment reporter Michael Slezak explains.
The climate time bomb is ticking.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres wasn't mincing his words as he launched the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's synthesis report.
But today's IPCC report is a how-to guide to defuse the climate time bomb.
The report summarises all the latest information about climate change, taking enormous amounts of data and simplifying it so policymakers inside and outside government can use it. It reiterates it's now unequivocal. Climate change is being caused by humans, and more than 3 billion people are highly vulnerable to its effects. On the Torres Strait Islands, Warraba man Daniel Billy is one of them.
A lot of the land mass taking out from the islands, and also we can't do crops anymore, grow vegetables because of the heat of the sun. Yes, very sad and it's scary at the same time.
Former IPCC contributor Professor Leslie Hughes says the report emphasises that the window of opportunity to ensure the planet is livable into the future is closing.
We really need to at least reduce global emissions by 50%, preferably more than that by 2030. So this really is the critical decade for action.
There is some good news. The report says solar and wind energy, improved forest management, urban greening and reduced food waste are all technically viable and becoming cheaper and more popular. However, the next version of this report won't be released by the IPCC until about 2030. And by then, scientists predict we will probably have failed to reach the goal set by world leaders under the Paris Agreement.
This is the final warning to limit the climate warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius.
Dr. Sarah Perkins Kirkpatrick from the University of New South Wales researches extreme weather and climate change. She says global leaders need to do more.
We have to do as much as we possibly can right now, and we're definitely not doing enough right now, but it's never too late.
And UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres had a stark message for developed countries. They must reach net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2035, and there has to be no new coal, gas or oil projects if the Earth is to have a chance.
Every country must be part of the solution. Demanding others move first only ensures humanity comes last.
From his home, Daniel Billy hopes the Australian government is listening.
We don't contribute anything to climate change, but we suffer the most. Stop digging into the ground because we are copying it up here.
That's Torres Strait Islander Daniel Billy, ending that report by Michael Slezak and Loretta Florence. Voters in New South Wales will decide this weekend whether the 12-year-old coalition government should be re-elected for a fourth term. Labor has to win 9 seats. Both major parties are facing the possibility that independents could hold the balance of power. And as Gavin Coote reports, regional New South Wales could become a battleground.
With its leafy streets and reputation as a food and wine hotspot, Orange has become a popular new home for ex-Sydneysiders like financial planner Jason Viles.
It is a fantastic place to live. But as you look around, you're aware that the school needs more resources, that the hospital needs more resources. And I'm not really seeing any solutions from either of the major parties.
Orange in central west New South Wales was once National Party heartland until Phil Donato won it for the Shooters, Fishers and Farmers Party at a by-election. He's recontesting it as an independent and has a very comfortable margin of 15%. Jason Viles, who campaigned for another independent in the recent federal election, thinks major parties are out of favour in the bush.
And it's fair to say with Phil, he's been a very active local member. He's very available, and that's what people want.
How entrenched do you think that is now? How difficult is it going to be for the Nationals or Labor to win a seat like this?
Once an independent member gets in, as long as they do that and actually engage with their community, genuinely represent their community, it tends to be hard for the Nationals to move them on.
But 50-minute drive further east, the seat of Bathurst is very safe Nationals territory. It's held by Paul Toole, the Deputy Premier and leader of the Nationals. And even though the Coalition has been in power for 12 years, Labor voters like retiree Leslie question whether the government has delivered enough.
Our hospital has had some problems. You know, they do throw money at it, but yeah, I've been up there, you know, because I've needed to go to emergency, and the wait times are horrific.
What do you think Paul Toole's been like as a local member?
Just out there, visible, look what I've done type of thing. He's definitely popular, but yeah, personally, no.
Warren Alban is a councillor in Bathurst. He believes all voters are worried about the region's health system.
Especially in Bathurst, because we're the poor cousin of the local health district, being out here in the east. You can't blame the government of the day. It's been something that's been snowballing for the last 20 years, but it's time to fix it.
It's quite likely Paul Toole will get re-elected here in Bathurst. What's less certain is who wins government. Will it be a hard fall for Bathurst going from having a deputy premier as the local member to just potentially being an opposition member?
Absolutely, I think. He's been very vocal, and he's been a bit of a powerhouse in Parliament. I suppose it's all in the lap of the gods at the moment to see what'll happen, but hopefully we'll still keep getting our share of the pie and get on with life.
If the winner isn't clear on election night, it could just be the starting point for negotiations on who will form the next government.
Gavin Coote reporting there. An investigation has revealed that ads promoting an offshore online casino were placed on Facebook to target Australians, despite it being illegal to run such a casino or advertise it here. However, Facebook's parent company, Meta, says the ads were placed by an authorised gambling partner. Casey Briggs reports.
BitStars, an online casino where you can risk your money or cryptocurrency. Registered in the Dutch Caribbean island Curaçao, it's a prohibited interactive gambling service banned under federal law from having Australian customers. In 2021, the Australian Communications and Media Authority warned it to stop operating here. But the ABC has found several ads from July and August last year which promote BitStars and which are targeted at Australian Facebook users. Professor Daniel Angus is from QUT.
The ads we've found appear as inducements for gambling. They include bright graphics that resemble pokie machines, often with the same kind of iconography that one would find in a standard pokie machine at, say, a pub or club.
The ads also contain Australian flags. They were found among ads collected from volunteers in a university research project called the Australian Ad Observatory. It's run by the Centre for Automated Decision Making and Society, and the ABC is a partner. Professor Angus is one of its chief investigators.
Potentially, there are many, many more people that have seen these ads and indeed other ads that we may have not captured.
In response to the ABC's questions, Facebook's parent company Meta said the company had reviewed the ads and that they were run by an authorised gambling partner. Under its policies, advertisers are required to get permission from Meta before running gambling ads and provide the platform with evidence that they're lawful in territories they want to target. It's not clear what evidence the advertiser placing BitStars ads gave Meta, and the policy doesn't require the platform to approve each individual ad. Professor Christine Parker from the University of Melbourne Law School says a TV station or newspaper running the ads would clearly be breaking the law. But
there's a bit of a loophole when it comes to the digital media platforms that are based overseas in the US. And the way that they've defined publication in Australia means that Facebook and other digital media platforms that have a global presence will probably be able to claim that they're not publishing in Australia, even though they've got a huge Australian audience.
In a statement, the Australian Communications and Media Authority declined to comment on this case, but says it can only pursue publishers if it's satisfied that most people who access the content are physically present in Australia. Dr. Charles Livingston is a gambling researcher from Monash University.
Now, if ACMA doesn't have the power to block these ads or to require them to be taken off, then I think the reality is that we have to give them that power.
In the meantime, he describes the current enforcement approach as like a game of whack-a-mole.
Casey Briggs reporting there. The gas industry has been trying to win public support for major developments in the Northern Territory's Beetaloo Basin by promising they could create 6,000 jobs. But a federal government report released only because of Freedom of Information request has found there are uncertain economic benefits for the basin's majority Indigenous community. Jane Barden reports.
Test fracking is underway on Tanumbrini Station, where Mark Raymond is a Jingalee traditional owner. He's worried about the NT government's plan to allow a major Beetaloo Basin gas development to go ahead later this year, and sceptical of the industry's promise to create up to 6,000 jobs and $18 billion in economic benefits.
I think it's all not true about employment and the benefit of our mob, you know. They all promised that, but in the long term, there's nothing for us.
A report written for the National Indigenous Australians Agency by consultants before the change of government made similar conclusions. It was obtained under Freedom of Information laws by the Ngurrindjeri Aboriginal Corporation, which represents some traditional owners. Samuel Sandy is its deputy chair.
Our people, we're getting a peanut on a white man's picking up his pocket.
The report concludes economic benefits would be uncertain and variable. It expects there would be 700 jobs in construction and operating gas fields, with few locals employed because they don't have the right skills.
My people never worked in a company like that in oil rig, and I think that job's not suitable for them.
The report found conditions aren't conducive to the basin's majority Indigenous community being able to negotiate strongly to get benefits because they're isolated and have small, poorly resourced representative bodies. It says NT and federal government laws don't favour Aboriginal interests, and there's a risk companies won't commit to corporate social responsibility. But David Slama from the gas industry body APIA says there will be many local jobs.
From a range of workers through from hospitality through to civil construction, through to waste management, through to skilled and non-skilled labour. We're talking developing trades.
The report recommends Indigenous communities could get more benefits if governments required informed consent and ensured Indigenous bodies were better funded for negotiations. It also suggests negotiating collective basin-wide deals. Associate Professor Janet Hunt is from the Centre for Aboriginal Economic Policy at the Australian National University.
By having an alliance of traditional owner groups, it would strengthen their hand. The other thing they could do is require these agreements to be public. All these agreements are commercial in confidence, so groups don't know what others have managed to negotiate.
Professor Jane Hunt from the Australian National University, ending Jane Barden's report. Australia's former ambassador to the United States, Arthur Sinodinos, has defended the federal government's agreement with the US and UK to acquire nuclear-powered submarines. The AUKUS deal has copped flak from former Prime Ministers Paul Keating and Malcolm Turnbull. Mr. Sinodinos has spoken with North America correspondent Jade McMillan after handing over his job to Kevin Rudd.
I think in the end what came through was a determination by the three countries, we're going to do this. And so the point I make now is failure is not an option. We've made our decision. Yes, we can debate pros and cons, but in the end, a decision had to be made by the Australian government, and they made that decision. They crossed the Rubicon. Our job now, as a nation, is to get on with it. I describe it as a moonshot in the sense that this is a whole-of-nation effort in terms of the resources, the people, everything we need to bring to the task.
Do you have any concern that a future US president could change or pull out of the AUKUS agreement?
The consensus I see in the American system, both at the administration level and in the Congress, is that this is the right thing to do. This is a multi-decadal commitment. People in the Congress on both sides of politics see this as the right thing to do in terms of the changing geostrategic circumstances in our region. So I'm confident that this agreement can proceed and be honoured by whether it's future Democratic or Republican administrations.
You've been a close observer of US politics now for the past few years. The 2024 election is still a long way away, but how do you see it playing out at this point in time? Who do you think will be the nominees on each side?
I think President Biden will run. He's gearing up to run. He's set up a re-election operation. I think he's convinced that his opponent will be Donald Trump, and he believes he can beat Donald Trump for a second time. On the Republican side, Donald Trump would still have 30 to 35% of the Republican base. In a crowded field, that's sufficient for him to win the nomination. Never, ever count him out. He's a very effective campaigner when he gets going. He did have a bit of a low-energy launch to this second campaign of his, but even from the way he can wedge the Republican Party on issues like Medicare and Social Security, when he gets going, he can be a very effective advocate. So never count him out.
Donald Trump has claimed that he will be arrested this week. He's told supporters to protest and, quote, take our nation back. What do you make of that kind of language?
Well, whether he's going to be indicted or not this week, he's very good at dramatising a situation for his own ends. And so we'll see what particularly happens. But it's good to see that some Republicans are pushing back and saying, look, whatever happens, we don't want violence, we don't want blood on the streets, as it were. We don't want to repeat, in other words, of the 6th of January. People can protest peacefully, but we don't want to repeat of any of that. We have to move on from that.
Former Australian Ambassador to the US, Arthur Sinodinos, speaking there with Jade McMillan. China's President Xi Jinping's visited Moscow for the first time since Russia invaded Ukraine over a year ago. President Xi has become the first foreign leader to shake President Vladimir Putin's hand following his indictment for alleged war crimes against children. Over coming days, they're vowing to discuss what China calls its peace plan for Ukraine. Europe correspondent Steve Kinnane reports.
There was no long table for President Xi when he arrived at the Kremlin to meet President Putin. There were handshakes, close seating arrangements, and plenty of praise. The pair referring to each other as dear friends as they sought to deepen economic ties to combat the West's attempt to isolate Russia for its war in Ukraine. In his opening comments, President Putin promised to discuss China's 12-point peace plan. We have carefully studied your proposals for resolving the acute crisis in Ukraine. Of course, we will have the opportunity to discuss this issue. We know that you proceed from the principles of justice and observance of the fundamental provisions of international law, of indivisible security for all countries. You are also aware that we are always open to the negotiation process. The 12-point statement includes calls to stop what it describes as unilateral sanctions and for the respect of national sovereignty, despite the fact that China is still yet to condemn Russia's invasion of Ukraine. President Xi said he hoped this visit would give new momentum to relations between the two nations. We hope that the strategic partnership between China and Russia will, on the one hand, uphold international fairness and justice, and on the other hand, promote the common prosperity and development of our countries. These talks will be watched closely by Western leaders. Washington recently warned that China was considering providing weapons to Russia, a claim denied by Beijing. As the two leaders met in Moscow, the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, Karim Khan, told international justice ministers in London that the issuing of arrest warrants against Vladimir Putin was no moment for triumphalism.
It is really a very sad occasion and a very somber occasion that for the first time ever, judges of the International Criminal Court, of any court, have felt it necessary to issue warrants against a leader and senior state officials from a permanent member of the Security Council.
The ICC believes President Putin bears responsibility for the forced deportation of Ukrainian children, and its chief prosecutor has called on Russia to repatriate the children immediately and allow them to be reunited with their families. This is Steve Kinnane reporting for AM.
And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast.
At the height of the pandemic, millions of Australians jumped at the chance to access their retirement savings early. Now we know a lot more about what they spent the money on, with a new study showing gambling was high on the list. Today we speak to one of the researchers. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.